Hello, Dan Gorman here, one third of the See You Next Wednesday podcast on Modern Superior, and you are listening to Death Watch.
This is Death Watch, the new show from the creators of Mammo.
Mammo.
I am one of the hosts of this amazing new show, Death Watch. My name is Matthew Price.
And my name is Matthew Brown. This show is going to be dropping on the 24th of November, 2017, because we post on the last Friday of every month. If you're expecting us more often, you don't know us.
That's right.
That's not what we do.
But we're happy to do this in a once-a-month fashion. Because honestly, this is sometimes depressing.
Indeed.
To talk about when people have passed, and you know, we don't want to. I mean, there's enough going on.
Oh, is there ever
in the world?
Yeah,
we don't have to be
yep.
relentless.
Yeah.
We're gonna do this daily, yeah. every day. You know, like at a certain point, we know you need a break. Yeah. It's okay. Work yourself up to this once a month. It's fine.
Yeah, for sure. I have started going through notable deaths in history to tweet out obituaries on the dates that people died.
Yep.
And that in itself is just an exercise in extraordinary depression. You're like, oh yeah, Mike Nichols is dead. That's
and I don't,
awful.
You know, and this whole idea of a death watch and what is death, and you know, it occurred to me this week because a long-running and kind of quite beloved film series, international film series, the Muff Society,
mm-hmm.
called it quits this week.
They didn't.
They did. For film projections. Yes.
Oh,
they called
I hadn't
it quits.
Heard that.
They're going to be an online community ongoing, but they're no longer going to show films in the three cities that they were operating in because it just became too onerous, too expensive.
Oh, that's too bad.
It is a shame. So I wanted to mention, you know, by way of commemorating them before we even start the show, but maybe it kind of plays into who we're talking about today. But
possibly.
But the Muff Society, a huge factor for the promotion of women in film and kind of women in culture,
mm-hmm.
In a really cool and inclusive way. So
yeah. Anyway. Damn, I hadn't heard that. That's really sad.
Yeah.
So the subject of today's show, we will get into in a bit more detail in a minute, but it is Hugh Hefner, the founder of Playboy. I'll give you
What?
Yeah, did you not prepare? Yeah, so like having gotten an entire...
No, I prepared. I'm the audience right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, I know. Getting an
Wait, in, you're going to who what now?
Right.
All right.
So I feel like we've got enough experience doing Death Watch now with that one big what? Show that we've
in
done.
In our experience of slightly under two cases.
That's right. Yeah. It's time to see if we can stretch this format a little bit because, frankly, it was starting to get a little stale.
Yeah.
No, I mean, like, I think, you know, we'd always conceived that this would be people who have had large impacts on popular culture, not just the
not
film
just
industry
movies,
specifically.
Yeah.
So that's why Hefner's fair game. But before we go there, let's do some of the plugs and shout-outs. So we're going to start with... before the show, you heard a pitch for the only show on the Modern Superior Network that requires no pitching at all, our flagship show, See You Next Wednesday, hosted by Dan, Casey, and Greg. They gave us a little bumper. We really appreciate that. They also gave us a shout-out on one of their episodes after we launched. But if you are on the Modern Superior Network at all, you've heard of them.
Yeah, and maybe you're here because they mentioned us, in which case, that's great. And we hope that you enjoy... whatever this is.
Yeah, exactly. So this would be a great time to point out that Modern Superior does have a Patreon or Patreon. I tend to vacillate between the two pronunciations every time I say the word.
I think it's Patreon in the same way that it's a patron.
Patron, yeah.
Of the arts. Nobody says you're a patron of the arts, so.
Don't they?
Well, I mean, unless they're, it sounds like a name you'd call someone.
Yeah.
I feel like patron is really, see that guy? Real patron.
That guy's a patron. That patronizing twerp. So anyway, for the low price of $2, you can get access to the Modern Superior Slack community where all kinds of conversations about
that's
movies.
That's where it's all going down,
that's
man.
Everything right now.
Yeah.
It is an inclusive place to discuss movies and music and popular culture. And of course, talk to all the Modern Superior podcast hosts, which would include us if I open Slack more than twice a week.
We'll get in there.
Yeah, we'll get in there as much as we can.
Yeah.
And then, obviously, if you go higher and higher on the donation content, you can on the donation points, you can get more monthly bonuses and stuff like that. We're going to have some bonuses in the new year, bonus content for Death Watch, which we'll describe a little closer to that release.
Yeah, but we've talked about it in a preliminary way, and I have to say, I'm very excited.
It's going to be good.
I'm very excited.
It's going to be very, very good.
Yeah.
And then in terms of other plugs, I believe we should talk about
you.
About you.
I mean, I'm the only other... I have the only other show in kind of regular production right now. You are somehow between the nine other podcasts that you maintain on a semi-regular.
Yeah, no, I'm not. This is it. This is where I'm focused right now.
And that's
now.
Great. Yeah. I appreciate that.
Yeah, no, I just got tired of all of the others.
So, fair. So episodes of Let's Scare Matthew Price to Death, which is my horror podcast that drops weekly. They are coming out. Season two is in full swing. By the time this episode goes up, you'll be able to listen to shows about Get Out and It Follows and John Carpenter's The Thing.
Those are three great things to talk about.
It is a stellar season of like just jam-packed with really, really good films.
Fantastic.
So, yeah, please check it out. If you can, again, it's on Modern Superior right alongside our show.
Cool. And we do want to give a shout out, even though it doesn't exist yet, but we know that it's on the way, which is that longtime Modern Superior hosts Jamie Dew and Greg Legros have a new show coming in the new year called Fully Completely, which, as I understand it, they're basically doing You Talking U2 to Me, but for The Tragically Hip. They're going to go through album by album, The Tragically Hip.
Song by song by song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great idea.
It is a great idea. I can't wait to hear it.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun.
Those guys know a lot about music.
They really do, and they're great conversationalists as well, so I'm sure that's going to be amazing. I did have a note here in the outline to give any feedback on episode one, if we got any, and there was not.
We did not.
We did not get any feedback. About episode one. I mean, there might have been.
That's
microphone.
Not true. We got some nice mentions on Twitter.
No, yeah, no. I mean,
people like the show. Come on, man.
Yeah, for
We're
sure.
We're doing fine.
We're doing great. I just mean nobody came in and said, you know, what you really need is a third voice there. You know, this show would really take off if.
Mostly, what I heard is, oh, that's what you guys sound like. So, for those that haven't heard our other show, recorded live in hot locations, it was kind of sometimes hard to hear us.
And oh yeah,
this is not the case in this beautiful environment.
Yeah.
So. Yeah,
we're nicely exciting. There's baffling on the wall. We're nicely damped.
I'm nicely damp.
I'm always damp.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
for sure.
Yeah, but this is what we sound like when we're damp.
Yeah, absolutely. God. So, which I guess
God can't help you now.
Yeah. And so, speaking of Death Watch, we would be remiss if we did not mention a huge announcement and change that happened in the last couple weeks, which is that the fellas over at Row 3. Where our old show, Mammo, was hosted for about 8 years.
Many years,
yeah. They just posted their 500th episode of the Cinecast, and with that, dropped the mic. They were like, that's it. We've done 500.
Row 3 is now
a thing of the past.
In stasis.
Yeah, yeah.
By all means, row3.com, you can still visit at any time and see past content, and that's where you can find, for now, all of our past Mammo shows and lots of other stuff. So I don't think it's going away anytime soon.
Nope.
If anyone is curious, wants to check it out. But there won't be any new content or posts or comments.
That's right. And so I guess that bears mentioning then that you know, basically applies to our old show as well. I mean, we didn't really create this show with the explicit intention of saying there will never be another Mammo, but between that and doing this, I don't feel like... I mean, we did a show like, what was it, about a year ago, where we were like, really... The burning need for Mammo has sort of died. Like the embers are still glowing, but they're on their way out.
Yeah, because, we're okay to.
Yeah, we're okay, and it's like
call the Death Watch on our own show.
Exactly. Like the conversations that we would be having are happening anyway. Sometimes they might even happen on this show. You know, like but stuff like well, there was huge news 2 weeks ago when it was like, Jesus, is Disney going to buy 20th Century Fox? And there was a time when that would have been.
To the Batcave,
yeah, like that would have been an hour-long show. We would have done a deep dive.
I mean,
we would have
done easily 45 minutes on Rotten Tomatoes withholding the Justice League score.
Yeah, for sure.
We didn't do that either.
Yeah, and it just sort of you realize that the complexity of that conversation is
probably
better served in other formats.
You know what, you guys, Twitter, the world, you guys got it.
Yeah,
you get it.
Yeah, you're doing great.
Yeah,
yeah. Further to topics that we would. Probably be discussing on our other podcast or just in general because it's all that's going on right now. This is why we wanted to do Hugh Hefner this month. I mean, I think I had the inkling to do Hefner before all this shit even really exploded. But the last month in popular culture, month and change, ever since, you know, the Weinstein story dropped at the beginning of October.
Yeah, we're recording this show probably like a few days before we actually post it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure whatever we mention now will be horribly out of date.
Yes.
By the time, I mean, we're only up to Al Franken guys. Right. We don't know what's going to come in the next like week or so before the show drops.
So, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So it's been, I mean, I want to be very hesitant with my language because a lot of people, particularly men, have been talking about how, you know, surprising and shocking all this is. And that, of course, itself is terrible because this has been going on forever and a lot of women have known about it and a lot of men have known about it. And the fact that it would surprise or shock any of us, really shame on us for not having the acuity to be aware of what was going on here. Yeah, I feel a little bit about the whole situation the way I felt last year about the again, another situation where my own privilege isolated me, the resurgence of racism in the United States. Obviously, it wasn't a resurgence. It was always there, just wasn't as aware of it. And I felt this enormous sense of disappointment that the human race was not in the state of mind that I had spent most of my life naively believing that it was in. And that's sort of the same deal here, where it's like, boy, I really thought we had come further than this. And I'm so disappointed and angry at all of us, particularly men, that we haven't, you know, that we're still here.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think there's a good reason why Hugh Hefner and his passing sort of brings a lot of this into relief. So I think what you're talking about is that, to me, is sort of the classic blind spot of privilege, which is you think that there are groups who in reality are disaffected or marginalized, who in your mind have the same footing already as you, a footing that you take for granted, right?
Right.
And in a way that's Hefner's, a guy we're going to get into it, but a guy who fought in many ways for the, you know, continued freedom of a lot of different groups, including gay rights, a lot of other things, but could never remove his blind spot about women, could never see their disaffection, their oppression, you know, at his hands, because he just assumed they were already equal on some level. And so that assumption is the, I think, what we're talking about here, that's what's being shattered in the last few months, which is amazing to watch. And, you know, this is one of those moments, this feels like a real watershed moment in history as we talk about this, because now that those floodgates are open. So the interesting thing is, right now we're talking about famous people who have been attacked or hurt, or semi-famous people, or people who are around famous people. But the next wave of this, as this grows and kind of grows in momentum, is, you know, hotel maids and, you know, people work like plumbers and waitresses and like people who are not famous, who have had the same treatment and have felt so far down the chain that they couldn't even, you know, vocalize their issue, right?
Right, yeah.
We're going to see a lot more of this, guys. We're going to see, and ladies too, we're going to see, hopefully we're going to see a destruction of a lot of entrenched power dynamics and a lot of entrenched powerful people, hopefully to everyone's benefit.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly hope all this is to people's benefit. I am aware that, you know, again, it is a point of privilege to look at a scenario like this and be like, you know, 30 or 40 years from now, maybe things will be a lot better. It's like, yeah, well, people will continue to suffer and be treated horribly in the meantime. And also, I mean, I think if the experience in the United States in the last few years has taught us anything, we also shouldn't assume that it's not going to get significantly worse as
people
reaction.
Recoil and circle their wagons and bear down and try to protect whatever they have.
Yeah, like if a decade of the Obama legacy could drive so many white people crazy that we get Trump, what is a decade of reconciliation with sexual assault going to do to people who are already crazy, like men's rights activists? And I just found out about this term, the incels, the involuntary celibates, who think that they are sexually inactive because women aren't nice enough to them. You know, if those people, those nuts already exist, you know, will there be another rebound wave of a kind of more mainstream version of that that sort of pushes this front line back again, as things tend to do? I mean, unfortunately, the reality of history is that it's a lot of effect, counter effect, you know, push and pull and these things. And I shudder to think what the next couple of decades could
nobody's,
be like.
Nobody's going to give this power up willingly, but it's. The more people challenge it, the more people want to come forward and challenge it.
For sure.
Sort of incredible to watch. The cascade is not around the fact that it's all new event. Like, it's not that there's more of it by any means, right?
Right.
People are empowered to, you know, they know now that they can come forward.
Right. We finally hit a tipping point and it tipped. And that's great to see. I mean, as much as it's also been incredibly painful to see, and I feel very badly for everyone who has to bare their soul with their story.
Sure.
And come forward with this.
And in a way, the people who kind of hurt the most also, to me, give me the most hope. So when you see an Al Franken or George Takei get you know, named and sort of called out for this behavior, people who on another level are kind of the good people, the people we want to like, that's actually more powerful to me, because it means that we're reaching a point where no one is going to be able to hide behind anything. You know, if they can take down, if they can genuinely go after somebody like George Takei, someone who has so many allies in the community that is actually affected by this, right? I'm not happy that George Takei did this horrible thing, but I'm.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm encouraged that we're getting to a level where it's not just, you know, the sort of right-wing Republican, because then you can sort of throw it off into, well, some people are good and some people are bad. It's like, it's not quite that.
For sure.
Simple.
So to drag it all back to Hugh Hefner, I think the first thing that we need to say with respect to so first of all, like, you know, last month we obviously did a show that was a lot easier to structure because we could both look at films by Harry Dean Stanton that we hadn't seen and build a conversation around that. Today we're not doing that because, there are films about Hugh Hefner. I didn't look at the documentary from 2009 because I heard it's quite a positive spin and so forth. But, the thing I wanted to say first is we're going to talk about a few different points that I found interesting. I have no interest whatsoever. This isn't my intent here is not to pass judgment on Hugh Hefner and whether or not his legacy is good.
Yeah. And on that documentary, it's not that it's – the problem is not that it's positive. The problem is that it's not entirely honest.
Okay.
Okay.
Good to know.
It's just not fully rounded.
There you go. and fair enough. I mean, it was interesting when he died watching a variety of viewpoints flood out very quickly. Some of them, you know, some of them very negative, some of them very, I would say, kind of even-handed, and then some very positive. And there's you know, in anyone who has the scale of impact on human culture as a Hugh Hefner did, and I think it's kind of inarguable that he had a huge impact. The outcomes of those impacts are, first of all, very difficult to parse because it's kind of like saying, okay, we dropped a boulder in the ocean. Which part of the wave was caused by the boulder? You know, like it's after a certain point, the outcomes get further away from the source, and it's like, how much of this was him? But it's also, there's so much of it. There's so much variance to the behavior over such a long period of time that it's very
we're not going to try to encapsulate this guy's whole life. We're going to look at specific things that we think are worth talking about. But I think the other thing to think about is that, you know, it's somewhat unique in that he is indivisible from Playboy.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are very few media objects of any kind that are so closely interlinked with only one person.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep.
And even past the point at which he had sort of given up the day-to-day reins of the magazine, it was still inextricably linked to him, his persona, all the rest.
Mm-hmm.
And so a magazine especially a magazine like Playboy, which regardless of your sort of individual feelings about various aspects of it, there's no argument that it was a preeminent stop in culture for a long time and spoke on a very wide variety of topics.
Yep.
So it's there is no way to nail it down in that sense. Like we could look at individual issues, but you know, it's not one thing.
Okay. So to start with just the brief biography stuff. So Hugh Hefner born in Chicago in 1926, which means that he grew up at the tail end of Prohibition and then went straight into the Great Depression. So he saw some pretty pivotal eras in the history of the United States. By the time he was 25, 26 years old, he's a copywriter. He's working for Esquire, asks them for a $5 raise. They say no, $5 raise. And so he goes and he takes a mortgage out. He gets a $1,000 loan from his mom and he starts Playboy magazine. And kind of notoriously, and maybe we can get into this a bit more, the first issue features a spread of Marilyn Monroe that he bought that was from 5 years prior. So like she did this calendar spread of her nude in the late 40s. He bought that, published it in Playboy, and boom, they're off to the races. They sell.
Realized that this now was relevant where it wasn't 5 years ago because she was now becoming a movie star.
That's right. And you mentioned just when we paused for a second that he was married at this time.
He was married and I believe had a child. And if you read that original Playboy editorial, it's very clear that what he's creating is what he wishes he was.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a revolt against what he actually is as opposed to being what he is. He's not a Playboy at the time that he starts Playboy.
No.
He quickly becomes that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and believe me, I'm going to read that editorial. But first, so in 63, he gets arrested for the first time for promoting pornography. This is because he published photos of Jane and Mansfield in a bed where there was a man present. They weren't touching. They weren't doing anything.
Correct.
There was a man in the photo. And at the time, and God, that just sounds so cute, that was suggestive enough to be charged with obscenity. In 1970, he gave what is a significant poll quote, which is that he said that militant feminists were unalterably opposed to the romantic boy-girl society that Playboy supposedly represents or promotes. I think that's worth circling back on in a minute. And then, so the magazine is extremely powerful right up till the end of the 1970s, and then in the 80s, it starts to kind of go downhill in terms of its popularity and its social relevance. It begins to fall apart, obviously by the internet age. The need for softcore pictorial nudes is basically non-existent. So in 2016, Playboy experiments with not having them, with refocusing on non-nude photography. I just learned in the research for this that they reintroduced the nudes earlier
about
this
6 months later.
Yeah, exactly.
Didn't work.
Didn't take.
Yeah.
And then finally, Hefner dies of a cardiac arrest on September 27th of this year at the age of 91. You brought up the first Playboy editorial, and this guys is a hell of a thing to read. So this is like on page 3 of the first issue of Playboy. I'm just going to read a few of the passages from here because it's just he begins by saying, if you're a woman, you've picked up the wrong magazine,
put it down. A ladies' home journal.
That's right. Within the pages of Playboy, you will find articles, fiction, picture stories, cartoons, humor, and special features culled from many sources, past and present, to form a pleasure primer styled to the masculine taste. We like our apartment. We enjoy mixing up cocktails and an hors d'oeuvre or two, putting on a little mood music on the phonograph, and inviting in a female acquaintance for a quiet discussion on Picasso, Nietzsche, jazz, and sex. We believe, too, that we are filling a publishing need only slightly less important than the one just taken care of by the Kinsey Report. The magazines now being produced for the city-bred male, there are two, count them, two of them, have of late placed so much emphasis on fashion, travel, and how to do it features on everything from avoiding a hernia to building your own steam bath that entertainment has been all but pushed from their pages. I emphasize the word entertainment because I think one of my first memories of Playboy, and let's be fucking honest, every boy in our generation has a relationship with Playboy from when they were young. I'm not going to go into that in too much detail because no one gives a fuck. But
there's very few men older than, say, 35 who a Playboy wasn't their sort of first real highly sexualized.
Yeah.
Right? Playboy's the gateway.
Yeah, I think so.
Usually.
I definitely think so. And so I always remember one of my first memories of Playboy was the fact that on the cover above the masthead, it did say entertainment for men.
Yes.
You know, and he mentions the word entertainment several times in this editorial, that's what this is. This is entertainment. This is so you can have a good time. He's trying to present the content of the magazine very lightly, very kind of almost flippantly. Like, this is no big deal. You know, this is what men should have access to and should have. And then, like you said, I mean, kind of the more fascinating aspect of this is that he basically just diagrams an idea of himself, an idea of the urbane bachelor.
First, yeah. I did some reading on this as well. What I found was so fascinating was two things. First of all, Playboy is, whether it is a positive step or not, Playboy represents a significant break from current thinking in 1952 or 3
mm-hmm.
about what masculinity is.
Right.
So the biggest, if you want to call it innovation of Playboy, is that masculinity prior to that was around being outdoors, being self-reliant, you know, wanting to climb a tree and mow your own grass and fix your own car. And it was very brawny man kind of post-war. You know, you have all these. So there, I was sort of thinking about this in the larger context of, like, when does this happen? And it happens about 6 or 7 years after World War II ends, right?
Yeah.
And what do you have? You have an entire generation plus, basically every man who would have been sort of the target market for this magazine had now not just come back from the war, but in a lot of cases had completed college through the GI Bill. So you have the most widely socially funded, educated cohort of men in the history of the United States, where socialized education has now propelled a huge generation of men through a higher education process and opened them up to a lot more ideas. And yet what they're being presented with in terms of what is being a man is this very narrow thing. The biggest deal about Playboy was it says you can be a man inside. You can be a man, and I don't mean inside yourself. I mean literally inside a building.
Inside the house, yeah.
Inside a house is where men can be. Men don't have to be outside chopping wood. They can be inside mixing up those drinks and making an hors d'oeuvre, for God's sake, which sounds... I mean, there was a real debate around Playboy in its first 10 years about whether it was contributing to what they called the womanization of America, which was this idea that American male identity was becoming feminized and that women were becoming the center of the culture in a way that clearly was not true. But also, you know, but is fascinating to think about that that as much as he simultaneously reduces women to a product no different than a glass of wine or a hi-fi, they're just another product that you can enjoy.
Right.
Right? But at the same time, he exploded the idea of what being a man might look like. I can't figure out if this is, like, there is something both positive and incredibly negative about that. But there is something positive about that.
Oh, certainly, yeah. And I mean, the other thing that I guess is positive is that, you know, this magazine flamboyantly presents an image of sex outside marriage without shame. It's like, sex is a recreational pursuit. You don't have to be married. You don't have to, he says acquaintance. He doesn't say friend, lover, partner, any of that stuff, right? He's just, you can have this, and whether it's true or not, and I mean, we'll get into the fantasy of it, but you can have this casual sexual relationship and you don't have to go tell your priest, and it's a perfectly normal male thing to do.
And it's and that women enjoy it.
Yes.
Too, and that you're not hurting them to be casually involved with them, whether that's true or not. But that's part of the mythos, is that everybody's enjoying it.
Right.
And that the thing that he hates the most is wives. And the interestingly, the article, the sort of cover article in that Marilyn Monroe issue is about women as gold diggers. that's the primary article in that first issue of Playboy. Is it's called Miss Gold Digger of 1953.
Wow.
And it's all about how women are, wives are this evil force. It calls for the abolition of alimony. It's quite if there's anything hateful in the early stages of Playboy, it's that stuff.
Right.
It's that anti marriage, anti commitment, anti partnership stuff.
So that's interesting, because that, I guess, suggests that his conception of this Playboy was that you couldn't have anything resembling this kind of lifestyle in a committed relationship.
100%. You know, that's his whole idea.
Yeah.
You have to be single.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what we have here is, I guess, a perfectly architectured aspirational fantasy of manhood. And like you said, he was not this person, right? So he invented it for himself as much as for everybody else.
He did.
And I think it's really interesting that this happened and the James Bond novels.
I was about to say, the exact same thing happened in the UK with the James Bond novels.
Started getting written at almost exactly the same time, and it presents the exact same idea of manhood.
They completely fetishize the perfect object, the perfect cufflink, the perfect apartment, the perfect car, the perfect woman.
Yeah, absolutely.
As I mean, all equally things you get.
Yeah, and I mean, and this is a thing that happens in a lot of fiction, but good Lord, if you want to know how to order a breakfast, read one of the Ian Fleming novels. And like every single one, At some point, Bond calls a concierge somewhere and orders his breakfast. It's never the same thing as the last novel, and it's always like, oh, that's how you do that.
Yeah.
You know, like...
Let me get those toast points.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. You know, like, it's so specific on the commodities and on the very tactical, tangible pleasures. And there's an obvious connection there to the sex, which the Bond novels are too, and so is Playboy, too demure to get into details about sex. No.
It's the one thing that brought to mind, interestingly enough. So when you talked about the pornography charge, there's actually there's an earlier harbinger of that, a really famous photo from, I think, around 1955. It's a great, I found it online. Mm-hmm. It's a great photo of the bunny in of that issue, the playmate of that issue. She's on a staircase. She's topless, mm-hmm. and her hand is behind her. And you see a man's hand, and she's leading that man up the stairs.
Wow!
And it's the most, and the hand is clearly Hefner's, and it's a fascinating photograph. I think it's from around 1955, and I'll post in the show notes the link to it. But it's quite a wonderful photograph in a way.
Right.
Right.
Well, I mean that is. I mean, I don't know. I haven't seen God, honestly, I have not seen enough Playboys to know. But it seems to me that there was a time when, from even just like a design and a photography standpoint, there was actually quite a bit. It was fairly leading edge. Probably not the leading edge, but like the photography was nice. The layouts were nice.
Yeah.
The design style of the magazine very nice.
Yeah.
You know,
women were not. I mean, if you look at what passed for pornography in the 1940s, that is some pretty dingy fare.
Mm-hmm.
That is some pretty depressing. There's a lot of sidelong eyes cast downward.
Right.
There's a lot of people are not having a good time mm-hmm. in most of that stuff. And this, you know, it presents women as a product, and that is clearly its downfall
mm-hmm.
and the sort of poison center of this. But it also presents women as a product,
mm-hmm.
a product that can be sold in the same ways that popular advertising sells anything.
Yep.
And so it means everything is top notch. It's all about the experience. It's all about creating a sense of enjoyment inside the photographs.
Right.
Right? So there's no room for a person who looks downtrodden, mm-hmm. who looks oppressed.
Yeah.
Those women look very happy, whether they really are happy and whether they're happy afterwards, after it's over.
Mm-hmm.
Different story, but I think it's clear that they are being made to feel, or at least being made to pretend to feel good
mm-hmm.
in those photographs.
Yeah, so there is a, you know, I don't have the complete text here, but there was kind of a famous off-the-cuff remark from him not too long ago, I think it was in the last 10 years, where someone once again said, but you've objectified women, and he replied, women are objects. Like, men have this visual-driven sex drive. And to an extent, like, we objectify women by nature. The human race wouldn't exist. I think that's what he said. Like, the human race wouldn't exist if we didn't, you know, consider women to be sexual objects. So whether consciously or not, whether intentionally or not, you're right. That's what he commodifies in Playboy. The fact that the person that a woman is one thing, and that's great. You can marry a person. Yeah. But the pleasure a female body can bring a heterosexual male doesn't need a person. It just needs a very brief character sketch in the notes that come after the yeah. centerfold and photos of her body.
I mean, even that was considered fairly forward thinking to have these data sheets and interviews with these women.
And, mm-hmm.
and like his whole thing was to always show them doing things that women would normally do, not to show them in weirdly hyper sort of
stylized,
suggestive yeah. poses. They're out shopping. They're picking flowers.
Right.
They're, you know, they're getting ready to go somewhere. They're, you know, they're naked while they're doing these things that they would be doing anyway.
Yeah.
So
the question is, you know, so the next, I guess, major point is the question of Hefner's sexual libertarianism. Right. So as you mentioned,
on a personal level or like through the magazine?
In the magazine and on a personal level, like So he takes this stance in 1955. He publishes this story called The Crooked Man, which is basically like a Star Trek episode.
Yeah, it's written by Charles Beaumont,
yeah.
who wrote many episodes of Star Trek yeah. and The Twilight Zone.
Yeah, yes. So we're in a future world where heterosexuality is the minority, homosexuality is the, quote, norm, and it's just...
It just flips yeah. what is going on with homosexuals right. in society in present day in 1955
yeah.
and treats treats or what's going on with homosexuals and treats heterosexuals that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, throughout his career, he takes stances like that. I've got a quote here from him where he says, "I have chosen every aspect of human sexuality and the discrimination that goes along with some of those aspects as my major concern." I think that's what he would say he was trying to do. Was he was basically, he is the alt-right for sex. He's like, get the government the hell out of my bedroom. It doesn't matter what anyone wants to do with their bodies.
Sure.
It's nobody's concern but their own.
And as he, I don't know if he pointed it out in that editorial, but certainly very early on, I think he pointed out, look, for most of the people in America, most of them are breaking one law or another through their normal everyday sex lives.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them could be thrown in prison.
Yeah.
For the laws that are on the books regarding sexual intimacy.
Absolutely.
And that seemed wrong, and it was one of the sort of the primary points that he was making, right?
Yeah, so he worked against sodomy laws, and you know, sodomy laws in some states also include oral sex, right? So he was working against some fairly
Knew that was sodomy?
Yeah, exactly.
I've been doing it wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. Or you've been
or
doing it exactly
very right.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Probably wrong.
Yeah, well, whatever. But you know, like this idea, you know, that to me presents an ideal of himself that is interesting, but the question you always have to ask is how much is he doing this out of some utopian sense of the needs of the human race, and how much is he doing it
because he just want to?
Yeah, he wants to scratch his own itch.
Yeah,
he just wants to, you know, work through his own kinks and fetishes until everything that he wants he can have and is okay. I don't know. We're facing this whole situation right now in the world where there's he's already the senator, or he's a prospective senator or something down in the States who's been accused of trying to date teenage girls.
Bob Moore.
Yeah, that's right. Roy Moore.
Roy Moore.
There you go. And
I apologize, whoever Bob Moore is.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Bob.
And I, with absolutely no proof and not attempting to tar him with any kind of an unfair brush, I have absolutely no doubt that Hugh Hefner would be firmly on the side of, if she was 16, it's fine. Right? Like, I don't think he would have a single problem with this whole idea. Young women fit perfectly within his idea of what, again, free-thinking adult males should have every right to expect. You know?
Yeah. Or at least to ask for. I think one of the problems around Hefner in his own personal life is I don't think he ever thinks of himself as being someone who forces anyone to do anything, because that's in his mind, that's not what he wants. Now, he is forcing women, especially later on, to do things.
Yep.
But he thinks he's not, right?
Well, speaking of people being blind to privilege and to power dynamics, you know, like, he has this mansion, he has these bunnies, he has them stay.
He needs to have three wives at a time.
Yeah, exactly. And I, you're right. I don't, this is a difficult thing to parse, because it is hard to say in a lot of sexual assault cases, is it blind ignorance or is it a fetish for power? Right. Like, when you look at Weinstein, there's clearly a power fetish. It had nothing to do with the sex and everything to do with the
and
power.
It's different from Weinstein, too, because Weinstein was just sort of grabbing people who he had there's no arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
He's calling people up to his hotel room under completely false pretenses.
Right.
And then trying to get whatever he wants to get done.
Hefner
is inviting women who have been in the magazine to come and live with him. And then they are. And it's clear. This is not me saying that what he's doing is right, but it's a different dynamic where they've been invited in, and it should be clear kind of what they're being invited in to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it goes so much further than they think it will go once they get there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. So, I mean, like, there were also a lot of articles written around the time of his death that looked at what I call sad old man Hefner, because I think it's really interesting that this guy created this idea of a playboy.
But then had to somehow become the ultimate version of it.
Yeah, and had to live in that set of rules for the rest of his life. And yes, he got married a few times, and he claims that during those times he was faithful, and who fucking knows. But, you know, when he died, he was Howard Hughes in that place. Like, it's great. Like, so here is a list of elements of life at the Playboy Mansion towards the end. All the girls had matching pajamas. A whole lot of not officially required blowjobs, but that was apparently his thing, right? Like, if you were there, you didn't have to give him blowjobs, but that would be good.
Also, he was giving these women allowance, infantilizing, weird
way of
approaching it, right?
He's giving them allowances. He's occasionally, apparently, having some of the Playboy bunnies share bedrooms with his underage children, just sleeping arrangements, nothing else, but like, oh, there's not enough room, go sleep in Jack's room. He's got, still referring to drugs, Quaaludes, as, and I quote, thigh openers, which in a post-Bill Cosby world is like the skeeziest thing. I mean, not that it wasn't skeezy before that.
How much post-Bill Cosby world did this guy experience?
Yeah.
I mean, well, it was skeezy all the way along.
Oh, but, of course, you know.
By this time, he was 89. I'm sure he wasn't necessarily up on whatever was happening.
No, absolutely. You know? I just think that, you know, if you mine into that vein.
No, I mean, he's one of the reasons Cosby was as successful as he was at what he was doing. He was doing a lot of it at the mansion.
Yeah. But you also have to be aware that, you know, when stories like this come out, and this is in no way to excuse any behavior, but you have to be aware that these cultures existed where this was considered not only normal, but acceptable and perfectly appropriate. Yeah. This is a way to get sex, is to drug a woman. That is one of the mechanisms by which you
just,
can get sex.
Yeah, just, you know,
sex.
Makes her more pliant.
Yeah, sure. You know, like those kinds of things. And the outcome of that, just from like a thought perspective, is all around us in culture all the time. Just the idea that, you know, that sex is there if you're willing to navigate around the reasons a woman wouldn't want to do it. You know, like this idea that the inherent state.
If she gets drunk enough, she'll free up and lose her inhibitions, and this will be the thing she wanted all along but couldn't admit to.
Right.
Which is a real silly way of.
Yeah, it's.
And ultimately scary.
Yeah, it's. It is.
Thinking about another person.
Yeah, exactly.
But you see it. So how much do you think? So here's an interesting thought: is you have this simultaneous rise of Playboy, along with, if you really look at sort of like from the mid '60s to, at least up until a few years ago, the rise of sort of frat culture and frat rape and that sense. I mean, that feels like of a piece to me.
Sure,
that you know the same. Lambda brothers are the guys, you know, reading Playboy as an aspirational handbook and then saying, you know what we need is more keggers. We need people even drunker than before.
Right.
So that we can really, you know, get in and explore this.
Yeah.
That seems like that's one of those areas where it's the most sort of flowery, toxic, gross kind of manifestation of it.
And I mean, so again, and I'm speaking entirely off the cuff here, but I do want to say that, like, it took researching for this show for me to really think back to the outcome of normalizing male sexuality the way it was normalized for me through Playboy when I was young, right? Like, I saw my first Playboys, I'm fairly sure I was, like, 7 years old. And as with all children encountering anything for the first time, I took basically the assumed rules of that completely normally. And the assumed rules were that women's bodies were arousing. I, as a male, wanted to see them. And again, as I was saying earlier, the dimension of that person was not actually relevant to that enjoyment. I didn't need to know who this person was. I didn't need to attach a person.
No, what's attractive is the physicality
of their physicality,
body.
Right?
And it is. There's nothing to say that the physicality of a person's body isn't beautiful and attractive.
No, of course not. But I do, you know, this whole experience has made me step back to, I guess, my very first set of principles, my very first set of assumptions about sexuality, and realize that, you know, this model that Hugh Hefner created, not the woman, but the structure, informed that entire genesis in my life, and it did for countless others. And again, this isn't the Pass Judgment show, but when you consider sort of this extent of toxic masculinity that we're in right now, around sexuality and also not sexuality, around non-sexual topics altogether. I'm not saying Playboy is responsible for it. I'm saying that at some point, this objectification, this commodification of women became so omnipresent that I do wonder how anyone in our generation got out of it. Like, how did we get away from it at all?
And have we?
And have
away
we?
From
and
it,
can
which
we?
We may not yet be. And I think also, you know, at my most charitable, I would like to think of this as a continuum, and I'd like to take the progress where we could get it.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think that we are in some ways definitely worse off, but in some ways Playboy was able to accomplish or help us accomplish some things that I view as progress or as positive. So I think things like the Playboy interview and centering someone like Alex Haley to talk to Miles Davis and you know, there are things about the discussion on race, especially among kind of white America, which was the audience for this magazine,
right,
that did improve. Absolutely did improve, because in as much as he was blind to what women felt, he was very conscious of a lot of other types of oppression,
mm-hmm,
and very much committed to using the magazine to help. Now, did he help by today's standards? Probably not, mm-hmm, but he helped, probably helped by the standards of 40, 50
years ago. By the standards of the time, yeah.
And so it's what's so interesting to me about choosing him as a topic is that it like I said off the top, it's never one thing. And there are so many aspects of what he did that I think, like even this idea of introducing different types of masculinity is still overall, I think, a positive, even though
mm-hmm
he never breaks through the barrier of actually, you know, like, I'm sorry, I'm sort of futzing around here, but it's...
No, I mean, it's an interesting idea that you could almost say he did a lot for men.
He kind of did.
You know, He didn't really, he may have harmed an enormous number of women doing it, and basically our conception of women as a culture, but he
I mean, I'd like to think he just didn't make it any better for them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he actually made it worse. It was already pretty bad.
Mm. Yeah,
you know,
I do just think he also changed the conversation a little bit about how that badness plays out.
Yeah.
And again, like, I mean, it's a little bit like, you know, when you're talking about going back as far in your personal history as your first Playboy, it's a little bit like being like, what would it be like if I couldn't see the color blue? Right. Like I have no idea. Right. Like I've lived my entire life being able to see the color blue. I can't imagine what that would be like, what I would have missed for that to not be the case. And it's the same thing, you know. With this.
Well, like even, I mean, let's just get real personal here for just a minute. You know,
sure.
I'm doing research for this show, and occasionally in one of the articles I was reading, like the subject of a specific Playboy playmate would come up. And so I'd go and I wanted to like get a visual of what the person looked like and then go back to the article.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a couple times that I came across playmates that I had seen in my formative years. And let me tell you, there's a reaction
mm-hmm. no,
to what is really like a pretty tame photograph by any standards. But because it's a photograph that I have burned into my pre-adolescent
mm-hmm.
memory, it was like, oh, I remember this.
You know, yeah.
That's something. I mean, it really does. It stays with you in a very powerful way.
It really does. I mean, I've got, again, I don't know how much I can effectively describe about this because the feelings are all so muddled. But I mean, I have a very specific relationship in my mind with the centerfold of the first magazine I ever saw. You know,
like name that person.
Her name, I believe, was Patricia Farinelli. I didn't know that until a couple of years ago.
Yes, she's lovely.
Yeah, because I wouldn't have known at the time that that was her name.
Peggy McIntyre.
All right, well there you go. But you know, like that, it is again there. I mean, this isn't really what this episode was going to be about, but there is a whole other conversation to be had about the fact that, I mean, I don't know how old you were, but I was pre-adolescent. Right, so
yeah, you were younger than me.
Yeah,
we probably had it happen to us in around the same year.
Oh, interesting.
Because you're younger than me.
Yeah, there you go. But you know what I mean?
I was 13 or 14.
Like I didn't know what sex was when I saw this. So imagine fitting
that. So
that's
an interesting dynamic for me. I kind of knew what it was.
And I think that's true of you know, a lot of boys, particularly now, you know, with the incredible access that the internet provides. It's like how are, you know, I mean, the wall gets built no matter what, but the order in which you're putting in the bricks probably has an impact.
I don't want to get too far down this side road, but I think it's an entirely other conversation that's going to be had 20 to 30 years from now, because our first exposure to mm-hmm. some of this is, by any standard of today, relatively restrained.
Yeah.
You know, if your first exposure at age 7 is someone defecating in someone's mouth, that's a very different early formulation of what you think sex is.
Right.
You know,
versus a softcore nude.
Yeah.
So, I mean, to kind of tie things up,
I'm advocating.
No,
for that.
Of course not.
Anyway,
just to kind of tie things up in terms of, you know, what I felt as I was doing all of this research is that, you know, and again, calling back to that first editorial in his line about the Nietzschean sex, it's like, I feel like Playboy comes along right at the beginning of the sexual revolution, or possibly even helps kick it off, right? And it's this weird pivot point between an old and very patriarchal, obviously, view of romance, courtship, and masculinity, and
where it really all centers on what the man does.
Yeah,
and if he does the right things, he'll get the outcome.
Yeah,
yeah.
And then and it's a pivot point between that and where we are now. And wherever we are now, I can't package and give it like a name, right? But it is sort of this hinge point that's happened in the last 100 years between a very long-standing view of relationships and this continuously evolving place where we are now. So I'm persistently fascinated by the impact that he had, again, intentionally or not. Like, at the end of the day, he was just a guy creating a magazine. He wasn't looking to change the world. And there were plenty of other men, pornographers, publishers of all stripe, who had equal, if not significantly more impact in different ways. But Hefner is an icon of, again, I take it back to James Bond. He's an icon of a certain type of masculinity that I think this culture will be living down for several more decades, if not longer. You know, until our generation is dead, and possibly the one after us, Hugh Hefner is going to have a space in how males think of themselves. And that's A, terrifying, yeah, but B, fascinating that there and are people that have that level of impact.
And he absolutely is going to have a serious space in how we decide what is sexually attractive.
Mm-hmm.
Because his ideas around what types of photography, what types of women to highlight, have become now what we call regular, normal, healthy sex. They're not any more regular or normal than anything else.
That's right.
But they're how they're the default.
Yeah. Yeah. He aestheticized the default,
right,
and we're all
which
just
is a woman
catch up.
About 22 to 24 with a very
usually good, white.
Usually white. Mm-hmm. And if not, the other thing I did is I went back and looked at the first women of color that were playmates.
Mm-hmm.
There was an Asian woman first, mm-hmm, to play into the ridiculous fetishization of, oh, Asian women are sex things, they know things about sex. And then there's the first black woman shortly after that. And this is not necessarily a criticism of her as a human being, but the lightest skinned black woman,
mm-hmm,
I had to look twice to go, oh, she is black. It's like she was as close to passing for white,
mm-hmm,
as I think I could possibly imagine.
Yeah, and I mean, colorism is something we're still dealing with very much now, where, you know, it is significantly easier for African-American actresses to get cast in TV shows and movies if they are mixed race or have very light skin. And, you know, like, this is all part of the same aesthetic bundle.
Yeah.
So, yeah, huge impact there. That does take us to the end of the points that I had. Did you have anything else you wanted to cover off, or shall we leave it there?
I feel like we can leave it. What did I want to bring up about him that we haven't really covered? I feel like we've done a good job of sort of putting him into context. So I don't really have any other... I mean, there's so many other things in his life that are interesting, including the fact that he started the Playboy Foundation, which was this freedom of the press, freedom of speech,
mm-hmm,
nonprofit, that he had his oldest daughter ran the company for him as soon as he stepped down, Christy Hefner, and, you know, that he was able to success. I think she's one of the first female CEOs in a company of that size.
Mm-hmm.
And so he is... There's so many contradictions. I think it's a fascinating life, mm-hmm, and I don't think... I mean, I'm very glad that Brett Ratner's not going to be the guy
I was about to say
to make the story of that life,
mm-hmm,
starring Johnny Depp as, you know, like,
yep,
the worst possible idea of that could possibly be. Thankfully, that seems to not be the case. But I do think that there is something there's quite a lot there.
Mm-hmm.
For someone to dig into in a dramatic sense and to lay out for people. So
yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you all very much for joining us once again. We will let you know that our December episode, which I believe...
Oh, are we going to reveal?
I think we should. Give everyone the chance to breathe and get ready, because even though this was a year ago, it still feels pretty fresh. In December, we are going to be doing Carrie Fisher, which is two things. One, it is an opportunity for us to pay her proper homage, or as proper as we can.
Yeah.
But two, it's an opportunity for us to talk about The Last Jedi. So, you know, there will be Star Wars aplenty. There will be other things. I've never seen Postcards from the Edge. I may choose that as my film. I finally read the book
great
this
idea.
Year for the first time. So
great
I would like
idea.
To see that
great,
movie.
Great movie.
But there's also, I mean, the thing about Carrie Fisher's career, well, there's so many things, right? There's the entire activism side, which we could get into in detail. But then there's also, she was an actress. She was a writer. She was an uncredited script doctor. You know, like, pick a vector that you want to explore with Carrie Fisher, and there's going to be plenty there. So you can follow us on Letterboxd, where we will be posting a list of pre-work films, homework films for that episode. I did post a list for this episode as well of just stuff that seemed related or even loosely related.
Tangentially related to
Hugh Hefner. Yeah. You can leave comments about this episode at modernsuperior.com. Once again, you can check out the Patreon if you're interested in supporting the work that we do over there at the Podcast Network. You can follow us on Twitter at DeathWatchPod. And we will be back talking to you some more at the end of December. Thanks so much for listening.
This episode has been brought to you by the Modern Superior Podcast Network.
I mean, that was some fucking four-dimensional sound on the coffee swill there. This is a great mic.
Was it? Let's try that again.
I feel like I went into your mouth.
Let's try that again.
Ooh. Frosty.